It was a young man who was appointed to escort Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin to shul in the morning in his older years. And Rabbi Yeshua Diskin, of course, one of the Gedolei Eretz Yisrael, Rav of Yerushalayim. And he said one morning he found Rabbi Yeshua Leib, we greet him every morning by his door. He found Rabbi Yeshua Leib, he walked out the door of his house and tefillin in his hand. And instead of making his way down the street towards the shul, which was down below, he started climbing a staircase alongside his home. These Eretz Yisrael staircases. And it was difficult. He was an elderly person. This was not a young person at the time. Passed away in 1898. Time of the late 1800s. And he starts climbing the staircase step by step by step by step by step. And finally he gets to the top of the staircase, and the young man's not sure if he should follow. He's kind of standing down below. And when he sees Rabbi Yeshua Leib at the top of the staircase, he sees like he's looking for something. He's looking in the distance. He's trying to see something. And after a couple of minutes, Rabbi Yeshua Leib comes back down. And the young man is just so curious. He says, Rabbi, what are you looking for? So Rabbi Yeshua Leib said an unbelievable thing. He said, we know the first two Batei Mikdash were man-made. A big discussion in Halakha exactly how and when one can build the Beis HaMikdash. The Pashto says it can only be built by day. He said, but according to many Rishonim, the third Beis HaMikdash is going to descend from Shemayim in a fire, in a heavenly fire. And he said, and according to that opinion, it's possible that the Beis HaMikdash could be built even in the darkness of night. So Rabbi Yeshua Leib said, I got up this morning, and I was just curious. I wanted to see. Maybe overnight, the Beis HaMikdash was built. So I went out and I climbed that staircase. It's difficult for me to climb the staircase, but I climbed the staircase because I wanted to see. I was looking in the direction of the Beis HaMikdash to see if maybe the Beis HaMikdash came down last night. And then Rabbi Yeshua Leib said to his Talmud with tears in his eyes, in such a real and sincere way, it didn't. It didn't. And we went to sleep last night, whether we realize this or not, it's possible to wake up to a Beis HaMikdash. For a tzaddik, for the Zakin of Yerushalayim, and the Gedolim of his time, it was a mitzvah. He would wake up in the morning, he would look in the direction of the Beis HaMikdash and see, maybe it came down last night. And he just shook his head to his Talmud and he said it didn't. And with his talisman still in his hand, he went to shul to daven. Maybe if we daven a little more, Kodesh Baruch Hu will give us a Beis HaMikdash. Last night we began the process of mourning the Korban. And of course, we begin with an appropriate question. The way that a mourner begins the process of mourning, not really sure what to do, but with just an echa, like, how could this be? Why? We don't understand what's going on. That's how we begin. That's how we begin Tisha B'Av. There's not a lot to say. I'm not even sure what we're allowed to say. And we just kind of blurt out this cry. Why is this happening again? How is this happening again? Eicha. But I think come to the morning of Tisha B'Av, and we start to go through the kinos. I remember a line that Rav Mendel Blasman Shlita shared in our neighborhood last year. He said, a kinos is not supposed to be a recitation, a morning spent of a recitation of medieval poetry. What kinos are, if you don't know what we're talking about. He said, when you daven Shmona Esrei, if you don't really know what you're saying, you're tapping into the words of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola. There's an inherent kedusha. There's a degree of Ruach HaKodesh, like the Chacham Sofer and the Rav Chaim said about Shmona Esrei. It was written in a very deep way. And while the tzaddikim wrote the kinos were also very great tzaddikim, and also in a certain sense divinely inspired, but the goal is that it's supposed to arouse a feeling, that it's supposed to chart sort of the mission statement for us. And therefore, in a certain sense, I think if last night the question was why, eicha, how, why, the raw shock of not really knowing what to do with the feelings, I think the morning of Tisha B'Av we begin a little bit, still grappling with the why, We start to ask a little bit the what. What are we supposed to do now? Mr. Mikdash didn't come down last night. We walked out this morning, we looked off into the distance. We didn't hear the shofar, we didn't see the Mikdash. We didn't get the text message yet from Eretz Yisrael. It's here, it's happening. So the question is, what are we supposed to do now? Because the why, again, it's appropriate for a period of time, but the why doesn't really get you anywhere. Just why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why this, why that? It's a way of sort of shirking our responsibility. Instead of saying, what am I actually going to do to try to change things a little bit? Primo Levi, a Holocaust survivor, had a very tragic life. He died in 1987, probably more accurately, he killed himself in 1987. Most believed it was a suicide. And he wrote a book in 1947 called Survival in Auschwitz. Survival in Auschwitz is true. He survived Auschwitz, physically survived Auschwitz. He was a broken person, namish a broken person. So much so that when he killed himself, when he died in 1987, Elie Wiesel said about him, he said, Primo Levi died at Auschwitz 40 years later. It's a very deep statement. Even though he was far from Auschwitz, in a certain sense, he died in Auschwitz. And he described what it was like when he first came to Auschwitz, hungry, thirsty, and just numb, sort of the feeling that we have a little bit this morning. And he writes as follows in his book. This is hell. Today in our times, hell must be like this. A huge empty room. We are tired, standing on our feet, with a tap which drips while we cannot drink the water. So the Nazis were tormenting them. There was this spout that was dripping water. The Nazis told them it's contaminated, you can't drink from it. And they're standing there, they're so thirsty. We wait for something which will certainly be terrible, and nothing happens and nothing continues to happen. And then he writes, and this is the line that I was thinking about. What can one think about? I mean, what are we supposed to be thinking about? We want to ask the what. So now what, HaKadosh Baruch Hu? What are we supposed to do now? What can one think about? We're so numb. One cannot think anymore. It's like being already dead. Someone sits down on the ground, and the time passes drop by drop. And essentially what he's saying is that if we don't know what we're supposed to be feeling, what we're supposed to be thinking, time can move very slowly, painfully slowly. And I think that's part of our reality on Tisha B'Av. Part of the reason that it's become more popular, if you could say such a word, to spend so much time trying to expound the kinos and trying to understand the kinos, is that to just sit around, you know, not just eicha, like, why are we doing this again, doesn't really get us anywhere. And therefore, he says it's hard to think, it's difficult to think, we feel dead, we sit on the ground, time passes drop by drop, we're not really sure what to do. But again, the avoda is to stop and to think. That's the avoda sayom, to sit down and to start asking ourselves, what are we going to do to make things different? To move past the why into the world of the what. A couple of pages later, he writes in Survival in Auschwitz on page 29. Driven by thirst, I eyed a fine icicle outside the window within hand's reach. I opened the window and broke off the icicle, but at once a large, heavy guard prowling outside brutally snatched away from me. Warum, I asked him in my poor German. Why? Why? Like, what's your problem? Like, why can't I have an icicle? And the German responded to me. I don't speak German. But he said, Hier ist kein Warum. Here there is no why. You don't ask why in Auschwitz. There's no why here. Pushing me inside with a shove. A Jew doesn't solve suffering by just saying why. The Jew has to respond. The Jew has to try to make something of the suffering, make something purposeful of the suffering, not just to throw up our hands and to say why. And this is, in fact, what Soloveitchik described in the beginning of his Kol Dodi Dofik. When the Rav spoke, again, in his magnificent language about what it means to suffer like a Jew. In the realm of destiny, man recognized reality as it is. Rav Soloveitchik said, our job is not to pretend that there's no evil in the world. It does not desire to use harmonizing formulas in order to hide and disregard evil. The child of destiny is very realistic. and does not flinch in anticipation of a face-to-face confrontation with evil. His approach is halachic and moral, and thus devoid of any metaphysical speculative nuance. You know, the Rav says, if you're just going to sit here and like philosophize about why does Hashem love us so much, why do we suffer so much, it has a place. It's a good question. We all understand the question. We all feel that question. Rav Soloveitchik said, as a halachic person, you have to ask halacha l'maisa. So what am I supposed to do? When the child of destiny suffers, he says in his heart, there is evil. I do not deny it. And I will not conceal it with fruitless casuistry. I'm not going to try to ignore it. I am, however, interested in it from a halachic view. And as a person who wants to know what action to take, I therefore ask a single question. What should the sufferer do to live with his suffering? What are we supposed to make of the suffering? In this dimension, the emphasis is removed from casual and teleological considerations and is directed to the realm of action. The problem is now formulated in the language of a simple halacha and revolves around the Quitodian task. The question of questions is, what does suffering obligate man to do? That's the question we have to ask today. Hashem gives us rishus to ask Eicha. We continue to ask Eicha through the kinos. There's a lot of whys. And it's not so easy to move past the why. But like the Nazi Machshavim said to Primo Levi in the concentration camp, in certain places the why is not, there's no why here. We can't ask why. The question is, what should we do to live with our suffering? That's the question of questions, says Rav Soloveitchik. And again, the avoda therefore becomes to not solve anything per se today. We're not going to have all the answers when we walk out of a Tisha B'Av. If we did, we would have put an end to this a long time ago. The goal is to stop and to think and to identify the problems, to consider the solutions. There's a tzaddik in Eretz Yisrael. His farm became a little bit popular after his passing. His name is a little bit more well known, although still not so well known. Menachem Froman. One of his children put out a sefer of some of his teachings. He was a deep person, complicated person. And he writes in a sefer, it's called Chassidim Tzoichim Yizeh. He writes, Limud Torah HaRagil Shol Tam Rabadli. He says, regular Torah, regular Gemara. Let's learn the sugya. Hu lish'ol she'elos v'la'anos aleihem. The goal of learning Gemara is to solve the problems. You raise a question, and then you bring a proof, and then the proof is challenged, and you bring another proof, and then you hear a different opinion, or Rishon Lakish is like this, or Yochanan says like that, and we go back and forth. Right? And once in a while we get stuck on a teku. But more often than not, the goal is to come to a resolution. Hilchasa, sometimes the Gemara says explicitly. He says that's the world of Talmud Bavli, that's regular Torah study. Today we don't engage in regular Torah study. The Shita HaYerushalmi, interestingly enough, the Yerushalmi is a lot more complicated, the language is more terse. The writing of the Yerushalmi is less refined. It's harder sometimes to find the answers when you study the Talmud Yerushalmi. But the Talmud Yerushalmi says it's Torah's Eretz Yisrael. It's Torah Shel Mashiach. And he said a person who understands the Torah of Eretz Yisrael and understands the Torah of Mashiach, Avodas Halimud Hi Lishol She'elos V'lav Dafka La'anos Aleihem. The Talmud Yerushalmi doesn't always have all the answers. An Eretz Yisrael perspective means being able to ask the questions, but being able to go weiter without the answers. Probably anyone who we've ever met, who picked up, who was born in America or anywhere else in Futzlar, moved to Eretz Yisrael, you go to Eretz Yisrael with questions. Very few people make Aliyah with a sense of absolute clarity how this is going to work out. But you know what? I know the challenges, and I'm going to do it anyways, because I know this is a move in the right direction. That's the Torah of Eretz Yisrael, that's the Torah of Mashiach. That's what we're working on today. To try to raise the questions, not necessarily to solve the whys, the big whys, but again, to have a little bit of a geula mindset, to at least say, you know what, I'm going to raise the questions, I'm going to try to think about what I can do to maybe help, maybe change things a little bit. And stopping to think is what the enemies of Klal Yisrael are trying to stop us from doing. The world is so fascinating. And it eats so fast. How often do we stop and think? When do we sit down, just like, you know, quietly like this, and just think a little bit, and stop a little bit, and contemplate a little bit? We're so numb from just the pace of life that we never stop to go up to that mountaintop and just look in the direction to see maybe the Beis HaMikdash came down this way. Maybe I didn't even realize it. Maybe things are happening all around me. Maybe Geula's unfolding and I'm just too busy with my work or my pleasure and I'm not paying attention. I want to read together a piece from the Medrash of Eicha. It's towards the very end of the Medrash of Eicha, the words, Yaganu v'lahu nachlanu. Yaganu v'lahu nachlanu, we toiled, but we were left with nothing. Listen to the words of the Medrash. And listen to how our enemies, Yimach Shalom, understand the danger of us actually stopping, sitting down, and thinking about what we can do. Nebuchadnezzar shchit atzamus, says the Medrash. Nebuchadnezzar made his bones rot. Tziva l'nuzradim, he commanded his commander-in-chief, l'nuzradim. V'amr lei ala hahon di'inon makabu balei tshuva. The God of the Jewish people accepts Balei Tshuva. The God of the Jewish people is moved when the Jewish people are inspired to change. The Yadur Pshuta Makabul Shalom, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand is outstretched to receive those who want to return. Cave in the At Kaveh Shalom, so when you conquer them, be very careful. Lo Tishvakinan Di Yitzalom, don't allow them to daven. The Lo Ya'abdun Tiyuftam, that they shouldn't make changes in their life, that they shouldn't do tshuva. Keep them so busy that they never have time to think. Because God forbid if they daven and do tshuva, their God will protect them. And that person, meaning you, the Nebuzradim, you'll come back to me black in the face for failing to carry out the mission of destroying the Jews, of defeating the Jews. Don't underestimate them. So what did the Nebuzradim do? The Russia that he was. Kevin, the Chavashiyas Ho, and so he conquered Klal Yisrael, he was destroying the Jewish people. Karabek Kotim Chad Min Hom. If he would see a Jew, he would stop. If a Jew sat down, like we're doing today, Havi Nasir Lei Lufasalei, he would come over to him and he would chop him down. He would kill him on the spot. And he would chop him up, Evar Mevar, and dividing up his pieces, his limbs of his body. Treifle Komeon. And he would take those pieces and he would scatter them about. The Inun Mahalchin Bal Karcherion. And Klaiyach against the run. The enemy just said, keep going weiter, keep going weiter. Don't stop, don't think. Don't, God forbid, take a moment to daven over this or to do tshuva over this. And therefore, Mahalchin Bal Karcherion Shalom B'Tovasom. We were pushed on against our will in a way that was not helpful for us. And therefore, the response, the victory, on a day like Tisha B'Av, they say we're not just gonna race through the kinos, we're not just gonna get this over with. We're gonna acknowledge this is an age-old technique that our enemies have used against us. From Paro, keeping us busy in Mitzrayim, the root of all gullus, never having a moment to think. And the Tzib says an unbelievable thing. When did Klal Yisrael finally wake up in Mitzrayim and decide to cry out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Sukkim and Shmuel say it was during those terrible days where Yamas Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Mitzrayim, died. And what happened when the king of Mitzrayim died? Klal Yisrael cried out, Ve'anuchu b'nei Yisrael, mena avoda. All of a sudden we start to cry. Why are we crying now? So Rashi says maybe Paro didn't really die. He had Tzaras, and he was bathing in Jewish baby's blood, and that's why we were crying. Other Rishonim say maybe we were crying to pretend that we were sad that Paro was dead, even though really we were so happy. Then it's Siv from Balajan has a penetrating psychological insight. Mehmet Bavar. He says, you know why the Jews are crying? This is what happened for the first time in a really, really long time in Mitzrayim. What happens when the king dies? Everything shuts down. The government shuts down. There was no work that day. The banks were closed. The post office was closed. It was a national day of mourning. So for the first time in a really long time, the Jews didn't have to go to work. It was a Sunday, like today, a day off. Shayu kol sarei paro trudim be'esfeido. And everyone in Mitzrayim was so busy taking care of being maspid paro. And therefore, even avadav ha'ivrim, even the Jewish slaves, also had a day off. And you know what happened when the Jews stopped? They took a break from building pyramids, whatever else they were doing in Mitzrayim, from the Avoda Kasha, the Avoda Sparach. You know, they were able to emerge a little bit from their own Kaved Lev, not just the hardening of the heart of Paro, but Chai Yisrael have been so trampled for so long. All of a sudden they stopped, they had a day off, and they said, whoa, hold on a second, what's going on here? How did we, the family of Yaakov, the distinguished family of Yaakov, become the slaves, the lowest of the world? How did that happen? And for the first time in a really long time, Chai Yisrael asked the question. They started to cry out. For the first time in a really long time, they never had time to think. They couldn't contemplate their own fate. What's the end plan here? How are we going to get out of this? What are we going to do to break the cycle of slavery in Mitzrayim? Is this going to go on forever? And when Klal Yisrael finally cried out, all of a sudden says, "Ah, Shkayach!" He finally woke up. He finally said, "What's going on here?" I'm sure they asked the why many times before, but they were starting to ask, "What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do to contact the Kodesh Baruch Hu, to get in touch with Hashem, and say we're not okay with this? We'd like to do something to make a change." This was the technique that Paro used against us. This is the technique that the Nebuchadnezzar used against us. And this is how we begin this morning's kinos. The first words of the kinos. Shabbos. What does Shabbos mean? Shabbos through many. It's based on the fifth parak of Eicha. Shabbos misos libenu, the joy of our heart is gone. We say every year, I like Archville's translation of Shabbos. Archville's translation, Shabbos, it came to a standstill. It was sort of the recognition that the Beis HaMikdash was gone, that Chorban was taking place, and everything kind of just stopped. Everything that was so busy finally stopped. And that's what we're trying to do today. Trying to just slow life down just a little bit, to think, to reflect, and to move a little bit from that world of the why, of the Eicha, into the world of the what. And to allow ourselves not to be overwhelmed by the enemies who just push us on. Whether it's a malicious enemy, or whether it's just the flow of life, or sometimes can become an enemy to colleagues. An Aaron of Bells, when he was running during the war, found himself on various trains, escaping amazing stories about the Bells of Rebbe, the fourth Bells of Rebbe of Arla, and his escape from Nazi Germany, and made it there to Israel eventually, February 1944. At one point he was traveling by train, undercover. Some Jews knew who he was. He was high up on the Nazi hit list. The Wonder Rabbi, as they called him. And the Jews were allowed to take a couple possessions, whatever they could take as a few personal items on the train. People took some clothing, some money, some pictures, photo albums, whatever it was, different people took a little something, whatever they were allowed to take. And Rav Aral had a little chair, a little stool. Maybe similar to, probably not like the beach chairs, maybe more like a little wooden stool. And that's what he took. That's what he chose to take. And every time throughout the journeys, whenever he could, whenever the train stopped, and they were unpacked, the Jews were sandwiched in like sardines, when he had just a couple of minutes to get off the train from one stop to the next, he would get off the train with his little stool, his little chair, and Rav Aral would sit down for a minute on the chair, on the little stool, and just sit, contemplating, thinking, just sitting. I told you the Nazis called him the wonder Rebbe. He was a wondrous person. Rav Aral had very unusual hanhagos. Rebbes have interesting hanhagos, how it is sometimes. But some of the Hasidim said, Rebbe, what's with the stool? What's with the little chair? And he said, quoting from the Hoshanos, Hoshana nefesh mi bahala Hoshana. One of the Hoshanos, you say, Hoshana, Kadosh Baruch Hu, save us from nefesh bahala. Don't allow me to be a person who's always nibul baal, who's always in a state of bahala, who's always rushing, who's always running. And when things start to turn bad for Haman, when all of a sudden he's being shoved around, you know Haman, the end is near. We daven, Hoshana, Hashem, save us from just getting crazy, from not being able to stop and to think. Rav Aral Belzer, He said, when a Jew is running from the Nazis, when a Jew is running from his enemies, he still has to know how to stop and to sit down and to think. And therefore, more important than a photo album or an extra change of clothing or a little extra food or even a sefer, Rabbi Arlo took his little stool with him from one stop to the next. Whenever he had the opportunity, he sat down just to maintain his composure. Hoshana midatash mibal. Hashem, help me to not be bubulbal. So Hashem should help us over the next couple of hours as we sit here together, davening together, learning together, thinking together, stopping together. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should help us not just to walk out of this day with another heartfelt eicha. Why is this happening again? How could this be? All the greater philosophical questions. Rav Soloveitchik said that's not how a Jew suffers. It doesn't get us anywhere. The goal is to ask, what can we do about it? What can we do to improve ourselves? How can we daven and do tshuva in a way like the Nebuchadnezzar was so afraid that Kadosh Baruch Hu's hand is stretched out to bring us back? And in Ritz Hashem, if we could just take some time, not even communally like this, maybe just a couple of minutes over the course of the entire day, just by yourself in a corner, on the ground with a little stool like Rav Aharon Belzer, just stopping to think and asking ourselves, an honest cheshbon nefesh, what am I going to do? What? Not why. But what am I going to do to make things differently? To make sure that the reality can change. And then, Mirtz Hashem, this day of Galus can be transformed into a day of Gula. I'm going to go to the hospital.